had we recorded the 71st edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast 3 days ago, feeling pretty good about yourselves. Instead, welcome you in on a Wednesday afternoon to the 71st edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast, where everything sucks again. Hi, everybody. I'm Tyler Mon.
I'm Anthony Masterson.
You know, it's the Rockies.
I think you're being overdramatic.
If you could sum up the series so far through in one word, I think it would go like this. I think you would go the Arizona series. You'd go, woo. Yeah. Good start.
All right.
Padres series, you'd go, okay. Cool. Giants series, I think you'd go, all right. See?
All right.
Team making a kind of looking all right. Cubs series, you think, yeah, hey, maybe this team knows how to play some good baseball. And then the Red series would just be the shrug emoji.
Just,
because I don't know what the hell happened last.
But third consecutive podcast we have recorded where the Rockies are actually above 500. We said the first time that would be it, and we have been proven wrong. They are 8-7 still. Off day coming up tomorrow, and the Dodgers coming into Coors Field on Friday. John Gray making his season debut.
That'll be good.
Yes.
Hopefully.
Well, you have to hope so, at least. But yes. But
where the Rockies get one exciting prospect back, they lose another one.
Potentially.
Yay.
Yeah.
That
Miguel Castro. Yeah. Miguel Castro, after the game, Thomas Harding came out with a tweet saying that Walt Weiss said that Castro was unavailable at the end of that game, which is too bad considering that game ended in a walk-off for the Reds in the bottom of the ninth inning.
Can we just go back to the play that resulted in that? Dustin Garneau was ruled to miss third. I was out walking the dog and listening to the play. On the replay, Garneau ruled to miss third on appeal, which ended up being the final out of the inning, I believe. Isn't that right?
Right.
So yeah. The Rockies end up losing what was at the time the go-ahead run, and they lose the game by one run. On the replay, I didn't see anything conclusive that showed that he touched the base. Now, I guess and I didn't catch the replay much because I had just gotten in from a walk. Now, I guess the Rockies' argument was that it actually looked like Garneau had stumbled over the bag. What did you take away from that play? Because what a weird way to end up blowing a chance to give yourself a lead.
Yeah, well, we'll get back to Castro in a second. But, yeah, I mean, there were screenshots taken that it did appear that Garneau's right toe was a little bit raised over the rest of his foot, which means that he was hitting it on something, which that thing at that point would have been the third base bag. So it's definitely
like the Zapruder film.
A little bit. I mean, it could be just angles. It could be something along those lines, but whatever, it happened and the Rockies are kind of got screwed over with it. It would have been the tying run in the seventh inning. The next half inning, the Reds go on to score three more. Rockies come back and tie it in the top of the ninth inning and then go on to lose it summarily in the bottom of the ninth. But
either
if anything,
way, I mean,
it's that so Rockies, especially on
right.
the road. That's pretty much a classic example of what the hell can go wrong with this team whenever they're away from Coors Field.
And, you know, the game could have had a much different dynamic going toward those last
right.
stages, which is kind of why the Castro conversation is a little bit different today.
So in a tie game, ninth inning, Walt Weiss sends out Christian Bergman, who actually started on Saturday's ball game against the Cubs at Wrigley Field, instead of someone like Miguel Castro, who hadn't pitched since Sunday, or even Jake McGee, the closer. But did you know that actually baseball law states that you cannot bring in your closer in a tie game when you're on the road?
Unwritten rules.
At all. It's actually impossible. Rob Manfred will come in and bar you from actually doing it, even if you're thinking about it. He can get into your mind and realize what you might be thinking.
It's like the Minority Report.
Exactly. Yeah, they'll stop the murder before it happens. They will stop you using your closer in a non-safe situation on the road before
the
it happens.
The murder of baseball life.
You just can't do that. You can't. So
Doesn't happen.
Yeah. So there was, and Rocky's Twitter was, you know, general consternation, which one is there not on Rocky's Twitter? But so why isn't Castro pitching here? And I was like, well, Jack had said on the broadcast that Castro was sitting because he had been overused and Walt wanted to give him some extra time off, and that's fair. Miguel Castro had pitched six of the first eight games, something like that. After the game, however, Thomas Harding came out with a tweet that said Walt Weiss reveals that Miguel Castro has right shoulder inflammation and that the team will soon make a decision on the disabled list whether or not for him to go. So every time you hear a guy like Castro who throws in the mid to upper 90s with a huge slider, and especially the frame that he has, whenever you hear right shoulder inflammation, that is just a lot of bells going off in your head. Like, this could not be good. What was your initial thought when you hear right shoulder inflammation for a guy of Castro's stature?
Well, I mean, I think your initial thought is always, God won't let us have nice things. Let's be honest, we're Rockies fans. There is no God.
There is no God. Come on.
But
come on.
With Castro, I mean, shoulder injuries, and we've covered this a lot. Shoulder injuries are the thing you worry about much more than elbow injuries. Elbows, you know, bone chips, bone spurs, Tommy John, all that kind of stuff. It's not easy to go through, but if you are cheering for a pitcher and he has to have an injury, you'd rather have him suffering something in the elbow just because of how much more debilitating shoulder injuries have the potential to be. So that's what frightens you about this with Miguel Castro. I do not in any way think that this is going to end okay for the Rockies, just because it's kind of what we're used to seeing permanently. But I do think that if it is just an inflammation thing and the Rockies give him some rest, then there's a chance that, you know, you put him on the 15-day DL. Maybe it's a minor thing. He's a young guy. You just don't want it to be something where, okay, there's some fraying in the labrum, there's an issue with the rotator cuff, whatever. If it's just inflammation and soreness, then maybe you give him a little bit of time off. Maybe it even doesn't require a DL stay. But I think, you know, we always fear the worst for pretty good reason.
Yeah, and there's no sense in speculating right now, because by the time you guys actually listen to this podcast, I'm sure we're going to know a lot more definitively what is happening with Miguel Castro's arm, whether it's good or bad. But, you know, it kind of makes you think back a year ago when Adam Ottavino got off to that incredible start, and then his season was cut short by Tommy John surgery. And the numbers are pretty similar. I mean, Castro threw 6 games, Ottavino 10. Ottavino, of course, did not allow a run in those 10 and a third innings. Castro had allowed 1 earned run in his 6 innings, a 1.50 ERA. 3 hits allowed for Otto, 6 for Castro, 13-2 K to walk for Otto, 8-2 for Castro, 0.48 whip for Ottavino, 0.67 for Castro, 0.94 opponent average, 100 opponent average, averaging about 14 pitches per inning for Otto per game, and then Castro 15 pitches per game. Like, the numbers are eerily similar a little bit. The Rockies have had these guys come out of spring training just blowing smoke, knocking people away. You're thinking, man, all right, this could be the start of a bullpen that can have a little bit of a resurgence in Denver, and then the main cog in it just kind of goes down, and everything goes to hell from that point.
That's really the crappy thing, is it's the excitement that you felt about what the Rockies were building was personified in Miguel Castro, because he is the model. I mean, that's what the Rockies have kind of landed on, is these are the dudes we want. We want guys that throw heat. We want guys that can get strikeouts. I mean, he's fanned 8 and only walked 2 in 6 innings. Opponents are batting an even 100 against him. He's got an ERA of 1.50, and that was only on the one homer that he gave up in his second-to-last appearance against the Giants when Brandon Belt went yard off him in the 8th inning of that 10-6 win back on the 13th. So Miguel Castro was kind of the guy that made you excited. And then, of course, when whatever divine being that will eventually kill us all catches wind
Cthulhu,
of something that we're happy about here, then he just dumps all over it, because we're not allowed to experience happiness.
Or one of the seagulls from AT&T Park.
So it just definitely worries you. I mean, with a guy that throws with that type of velocity, a shoulder thing worries you. A shoulder thing worries you with anybody, but with somebody who throws like that, it worries you even more. The Rockies, I don't really know how to... I think, to an extent, maybe you don't worry about it quite so much because of the fact that Walt was pretty upfront about, it's some inflammation. We're trying to make a decision on, you know, whether or not this requires a DL stay. Remember how weirdly close-lipped they were about everything with Adam last year?
Right.
When Adam Ottavino went out, it was, Adam's taking some time off, because he's been overused. And then there were some, like, very weird cryptic moments on the broadcast where it seemed like the radio and TV guys knew that there was the potential that Adam was going to need Tommy John surgery, but they weren't really talking about it. I mean, they made some quick allusions on the broadcast and then backtracked really quickly. I mean, it doesn't seem like that's going on right now with Miguel Castro. I'm not suggesting anything malicious, but, I think it's just the Rockies usually try to keep that stuff really close to the vest and, you know, to at least come out and say, say, no, Castro is out because of this reason, maybe that gives you a little bit of hope. But yeah, you certainly fear the worst, because it's generally the worst.
Yeah, because everything's always the worst.
Yeah.
Did you not know that?
So that's great.
Now you know.
But the one thing that could be a little bit of an antidote to that is the news that was made official today, which is that John Gray will return to the Rockies rotation coming up on Friday. The former first-round pick back in the 2013 draft, the third overall selection out of the University of Oklahoma. Hi, Chris Christman. John Gray, this season, has made two rehab starts with the Class A Advanced Modesto Nuts in the California
Modesto
League.
Modesto Nuts.
Oh, I thought you were going to continue it.
No. I just wanted to get that part in there.
Oh, okay.
Like, whenever we talk about a certain minor league team, we just have to sing their jingle
Pop
for
the jingle.
2 seconds.
Yeah.
Eat it up. The Modesto Nuts.
We also did an entire episode of the Minor League Baseball podcast this week that is all about team theme songs, and Eat It Up is very heavily featured, so you should go download that.
How could it not be?
Because it's the greatest jingle ever written.
Probably the greatest jingle ever written. Like
for
that
anything.
And like
not
Mentos.
Just baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Do 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 do.
You idiot.
You're an idiot. John Gray has made two appearances, though, however, in Modesto rehab appearances. In his last one, very, very good. Four innings. No earned runs. Gave up three runs, but all unearned. Eight strikeouts compared to just two walks in those four innings of work, and just toying with children as he did in those couple rehab starts. So good to see John Gray getting back in, and he is ready to go. And this is time for John Gray. This is John Gray's time to prove that he can stick with his pitching staff, because he is joining a pitching staff right now that, surprisingly enough, has been very, very good, even if you don't realize it. Even take away those two games against the Padres, which, what the hell happened there? Even with those two games added, the Rockies pitching staff is still top 10 in the league in strikeout-to-walk ratio. They are still top 10 in walks per nine. They are not hurting themselves in that respect. Don't talk about the errors they've committed. We're just going to gloss over those. Still last in the league in ERA because of those, you know, games against the Padres, but only 23rd in the league in FIP. But the last seven games, the rotation, individually, they're 4-2. The team is 4-3. A 2.72 ERA in the last seven games for the starting rotation. 39 strikeouts to just eight walks. Only four homers allowed. And a 182 average against. They have five quality starts in that time as well. The pitching staff, especially this rotation, has been very, very impressive as of late.
That is always the big question going into any season. It's, can the Rockies get enough quality work from the starting pitching, yada, 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 yada. I think they have proven that they can. Will this last all season? No, of course it's not going to last all season. But I think even if they regress to a mean, showing that this is the best case scenario gives you a little bit more confidence in what the average performance is going to look like from this starting rotation on a regular basis. And, oh, by the way, you are now adding the guy who has the potential to be the best among them starting on Friday with John Gray.
Definitely the highest ceiling, for sure.
Absolutely. I mean, Jorge De La Rosa and what he's accomplished in his Coors Field career and his Rockies career, you know, may never be equaled, but in terms of stuff, in terms of ability, in terms of just flat-out ace potential, the Rockies have never really had anybody like John Gray. But you're right. This is the time when John Gray needs to prove that he can stick, because the Rockies need it. It's not so much on John Gray, because he's still 24 years old.
Yes.
But the Rockies, I mean, you know, we all know it better than anybody. The Rockies are so starved for somebody to prove they can be an ace here. And John Gray has all the qualities to do it. And God, wouldn't it just be nice to, once after wandering in the goddamn desert for 23 years, wouldn't it just be nice to have one dude who every 5 days he goes out and take the ball and you think, hell yeah, I cannot wait to watch John Gray throw.
Yeah.
And that's how it felt last season.
Yeah,
you know?
It was. There were definitely flashes for John Gray last year. And of course, he was on the whatever 75 pitch count or whatever. The kid gloves will mostly be off. He'll probably start a little bit slowly just because he's coming back from an injury. But, you know, we saw the flashes, the one hit performance at Citi Field last year. But that was the one, first one that comes to mind. But the splits were there last year for John Gray, home and road. Coors Field was a little bit in his head. 8.27 ERA in five starts at Coors Field, a 2.70 ERA in four starts away from home. That's a 5.5 run difference in ERA in about the same amount of innings, 20 and two thirds at home, 20 on the road. Like it or not, those numbers have to at least get into John Gray's head a little bit. We've even heard him say that, you know, in interviews, you know, it is what it is. Coors Field, a different kind of beast. And, you know, at some point you have to just let that go out of your mind completely. Just go out there and pitch the way that you have before your entire life, because clearly, as we've seen so far, you are able to pitch at Coors Field. If you don't have to go very far to see that you can do it, because even in the last seven games, albeit six of them on the road, the starting staff has gone at least five innings in all but one game. I mean, guys can pitch at Coors Field. It's not something that is completely like foreign at all. It's happened before. It can happen again, and it will happen again. But John Gray has to be the guy who can put it out of his mind and just say, grab the baseball, just say, screw it, I'm going to go out there and pitch my ass off. He has to come and do that this year, especially at home.
Chris Jackson, our good pal from the Albuquerque Examiner, last season, after that interview in which John Gray said, yeah, Coors Field is different. There's something about this ballpark. I haven't been able to figure it out yet, yada, yada. Everybody here freaked out because it's so trendy to just say, oh, Coors Field's already gotten in his head. He's already beaten. The Rockies have ruined another one. This guy sucks. Chris Jackson, who is, what's the word, good, and also, you know, like understands how to be measured in his evaluation of prospects. He said, also, that's the official mascot of the PDP, Laika, the cattle dog shaking so you all can hear her and she can say hi.
Hi, Laika. Who's a pup?
Chris Jackson said, John Gray said a lot of similar things early on this season. This is in 2015 when he got started with Albuquerque. Struggled a little bit out of the gate, as we know. I mean, really had his struggles in April last year. But he was open about the fact that he knew he needed to make adjustments. And when he did, he took off. So rather than it being the hot take brigade of, you know, a beat writer for the newspaper calling Jorge De La Rosa unprofessional in a tweet and then deleting it, rather than it being that kind
that's classy as hell.
That regular level of take. I think John Gray is an analytical guy who doesn't really worry about the fact that he can say something to the media and everybody's going to freak the hell out about it. I think he just realizes, no, it's a different animal. I got to figure out how to tame it, but I can do that. John Gray's stuff can succeed anywhere. And John Gray mentally can succeed anywhere. It's very difficult for anyone to put those things together, and it's exceptionally difficult to do that at Coors Field. But if anybody is going to be able to, John Gray has the best pedigree of anybody this organization has ever had. So I don't worry about that. Everybody last year freaked the hell out when he said that. I don't worry about that because I think it's just John Gray's way of saying, no, this is a different challenge for me, but I'm going to figure out how to get it done.
And you look at what he did last year in Albuquerque, and Chris Jackson's absolutely right. His first four appearances with the Isotopes in 17 and two-thirds, he had a 10.70 earned run average. In the month of May, he took that down all the way to 2.78. A little blip in June, 4.06, but then July in six starts, back down to 2.70. So yeah, he started out poorly in Albuquerque, a very similar kind of place. You're up at the high elevation. There's a lot of wind running around there, knocking the balls out of the park. It's a tough place to pitch. It got in his head a little bit at first, but then he made the adjustments that were necessary to become an excellent pitcher in that league. And in the PCL, it is hard to put together a couple of months where you have ERAs under three as a starting pitcher, and he did that last year. So the stuff is there. The makeup is there for John Gray, and it's time to put all that together and into the results on the field.
John Gray, the thing that I really like about him, too, is how excited he is to get rolling. I mean, the quotes that he's given about how good he feels, about how excited he is to be back, all of that, that is what I think gives you an indication of where John Gray is. It's not just, oh yeah, I mean, this is a highly touted prospect and yada, yada. It's that John Gray wants to be great. John Gray wants to be the guy who leads. He wants to be the tip of the spear of all these prospects. He wants to lead the Kyle Freelands and the Jeff Hoffmans and the Antonio Senzatellas and all those guys into the next chapter of this organization.
The promised land after wandering in the desert. We're going to bring it all back around, guys.
Right, exactly.
Get with it.
But that's what I like about John Gray is it's not just that he's ready to be back because he wants to be in the big leagues, whatever. It's that John Gray is fired up. He's figured out a way to, you know, something with his delivery that he said he's not flying open quite as much, which constrained the abdominal areas where he suffered the injury in spring training. All of that stuff is, to me, an indication that he is so hungry to be here that it's going to be a very fun season to watch for him. The Rockies need it. They need to see somebody break in and stick and be that good. And if anybody's going to do it, I think it's going to be John Gray.
I completely agree. Now we got to see it happen on Friday. I'm down.
Against a team that you really want to see it happen against, too.
Oh, yeah, of course. Dodgers.
the Rockies will go against the Dodgers at home. They'll welcome in the Pittsburgh Pirates following that next week. And this is a very tough stretch. And the Rockies will have a very tough stretch with that road trip in mid-May that we talked about last week, too. But, you know, right now, this is what we've come to expect from them over the last few seasons in April. The question is going to be, are you going to be the 2014-2015 Rockies that fall apart in May? Or can you be, like we've talked about from week to week, can you be the 2006 Rockies who continue this type of relatively leveled out play throughout the entirety of a season and set yourselves up with some groundwork for next year?
Yeah, and time will tell. These are the times we can do it, because he came off a 3-3 road trip, albeit not the way you would necessarily want after winning two of the first three at Wrigley Field. But it's a team that's playing fairly well right now. And Trevor Story, his hot start has kind of gone by the wayside, but he's still getting on base, hitting the ball, still swinging and missing, but that's what he does. Arenado's been good. Cargo just got his 1,000th hit of his career today. He has been knocking the absolute piss out of the ball. This team is hitting, the team is pitching, and they've had a couple of close losses here. I mean, the last two losses came by one run. It's different right now for the Rockies. Yeah, it's April, and obviously that's a little bit of a different story, as always it is with the Rockies in April, but the team is playing pretty well. There's no reason to get upset about it, because it's early, and there's still a lot of season left, guys.
Unless you're the Denver Post, which for some reason, the first headline on the Post sports page right now is, since 1993, the Rockies have the worst record in the National League West against division rivals. Okay.
Cool.
Okay.
Cool.
Cool journalism.
Cool.
The Rockies made another move today, which was way under the radar. I did not hear about this until just now, but according to the Associated Press, quote, the Rockies acquired first baseman Cody Decker from the Kansas City Royals in exchange for cash on Wednesday. He was assigned to AAA Albuquerque. Decker, 29, was hitting .278 with 3 home runs and 5 runs batted in over 7 games with AAA Omaha this season. Signed with the Royals as a free agent after spending 7 seasons in the San Diego system, including an 8-game stint with the Padres, during which he went over 11 last season. That was his major league debut. Made that very late. The reason why this is exciting is Cody Decker is like the most likable dude in all baseball. Go find his Twitter profile. He's at Decker6. He makes some hilarious YouTube videos. He's the one who did the prank with Jeff Francoeur, where he and a few teammates convinced Jeff Francoeur that one of their relievers on the pitching staff was deaf. I think this was last year
in
El Paso.
It's not mean, because it was very funny.
It was hysterical. It was either last year or 2 years ago.
Yeah.
But Cody Decker is an insanely likable dude, and that's exciting. I mean, he's an organizational guy. He's, somebody will provide a little bit of depth in the Rockies right now. Obviously, you see the way that the diversity in positions for the Rockies kind of, whenever there is an injury anywhere, can challenge your depth. I mean, Charlie Blackmon goes out, and that ends up affecting your first base situation, because Ben Paulson has to get regular starts in the outfield now. But so, Cody Decker, in case something happens to somebody like Ben Paulson or to somebody like Mark Reynolds, if the Rockies need an option at first base to fill in, Cody Decker is there until, Ryan McMahon maybe is your first baseman in the future. Who knows?
Cody,
but that's
Decker,
exciting.
Yeah, 157 career minor league homers, a career minor league OPS of .875. This is a funny story. I was in spring training a couple of times this year, and I kept seeing the Royals for whatever reason. And watching at Scottsdale Stadium, it was late in the game, all the minor league kids were in. And Cody Decker stepped up against, I believe it was George Contos, who's a major league reliever, and hit one about 510 feet to dead center field off Contos. And he's this 5'11", 225-pound, squat little guy who has got absolute moon tower power. And the second that we saw him, we're like, all right, new favorite player right here, before we even realize it. Oh, it's that Cody Decker. So just getting him back in the Rockies organization, or getting him in the Rockies organization, is a very, very exciting prospect.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, he's there are very few guys who, didn't make their big league debuts until they were 28 that you're going to be that excited about. But Cody Decker is a cult hero.
He's a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's a hell of a lot of fun. So you know, if you make it down to a Tobes game this year, Cody Decker is a super easy guy to cheer for, and maybe we'll see him up in Denver at some point this season. Let's continue along with some conversation about this Colorado Rockies start to the 2016 season. The Rockies will come home at 8-7. But as Anthony noted, the thing that is sticking out right now is the rotation. And to me, this is, you know, kind of what I said a few minutes ago. We've seen now what the best case scenario can be for this Rockies rotation. And, you know, because we're the Monfort Water Boys or whatever we are,
yep,
we're not going to say I told you so. But this is what we've been trying to say for quite some time. Chad Bettis is really good. Tyler Chatwood is really good. Jordan Lyles can be really good. Jorge De La Rosa, you know what you're getting from him once the calendar turns to May. And John Gray may be the best of all of them. We're not going to see him until Friday. I mean, right now, you got to feel good about the fact that the Rockies can hang around level this year. They can hang around 500 if the pitching staff throws anything near what it's doing right now. Over this last week, I should say. Not those games against the Padres.
I mean, I like Preferably the fact that they're not killing themselves with the walk. And that's always been a problem for the Rockies for the last few years when they've been terrible. I mean, I mentioned before, right now they're top 10 in the league in strikeout to walk ratio as an entire pitching staff. They're top 10 in walks per nine. That's a very, very good sign. If you give up hits, you're going to in Denver. You're going to give up home runs in Denver. That's going to happen. But as long as you don't kill yourself by allowing free passes, you at least give yourself a fighting chance. And that is what these guys have done right now. Chad Bettis right now, 19 Ks to just six walks on the season. Tyler Chatwood, he's not a big strikeout guy anyway, but he has been very good in that respect as well. A 12-2 K to walk ratio. I mean, De La Rosa has been good in that respect too. The last start notwithstanding, 23 strikeouts, just nine walks in that time. Everybody besides Jordan Lyles before that last start against the Reds in the first game of that series has been very good in that respect and limiting the amount of free passes they allow on the base paths. And that is such a huge key for Rockies pitching to be successful. And they've made strides on that clearly this year. Whatever Steve Foster and Darren Holmes have been working with these guys on, clearly it is taking. And that's a very, very good sign.
That is something that, you know, we talk about. It's big for Rockies pitchers to be able to get strikeouts. It's big for Rockies pitchers to be able to, you know, throw hard because fastballs are a little bit more effective, maybe. I mean, based on what we've read now in the Rockies' recent study of analytics, maybe they're a little bit more effective at altitude than people had previously realized. What is also huge and what is constantly beat into us by Rockies Twitter, which I think is generally we're just taking shots at Rockies Twitter. I think this is very accurate that Rockies Twitter continually puts out. Walks kill you. When you are the Rockies, walks kill you exponentially more because you cannot afford at Coors Field to hand away base runners and then all of a sudden have some broken bat bleeder bring home two runs and turn, you know, a close game into a rout or turn around a lead into a deficit or whatever it is. So that is maybe an underrated side of what Jeff Breidich and Zach Wilson and the, you know, the player personnel staff has been trying to build. Is it's not just guys who can throw hard and get strikeouts. There are good command guys on the staff right now too.
Yeah, and it's coming from everywhere. It's not just starting rotation. I mean, Jake McGee has been very good in limited time when he's been in. Obviously, Miguel Castro had been very, very good before his, you know, whatever just happened there. Yeah, and even Boone Logan, you know, the much maligned Boone Logan, I should say. He has been excellent this year when he has been put into a situation to succeed. Overall, the ERA is at 3.86.
What a novel idea.
Yeah, right? Shocking. But the ERA is at 3.86. But against left-handed batters this year, they are 2-16 against Boone Logan with 7 strikeouts after today.
Boone Lagoon. No, I mean, so, you know, I think it was Jordan Freemeyer who put it on Twitter today. You know, how surprising when you put your left-hander in a position to succeed, generally he succeeds. And that was something that we talked about a good amount last year was, yeah, Boone Logan overall, his numbers are not good. But when you look at his numbers in the situations that Boone Logan is really the guy who is set to pitch for, you know, in those loogie type of situations, he's very successful. Now, is Boone Logan the best member of the Rockies pitching staff just for what you need? You can't build a bullpen in Colorado the way you build it everywhere else because people are going to be beat up. You need guys who are a little bit more versatile than just that left-handed one-out guy. But
you need three long men like Christian Bergman and Chris Russett and the guys they have in there right now, Jason Gurka.
And yet, when Boone Logan is put in a situation that he is best suited for, he is successful. Man, we're complimenting Boone Logan on the show.
I feel like a lot of people would be successful by putting their best situation.
Yeah, it's just so often something that the Rockies, A, don't have the luxury of doing because the bullpen's always so beat up, or B, mismanaged totally. And that's not a shot, you know, at Walt Weiss. I mean, that's throughout franchise history. I mean,
it is, and it isn't, man. Yeah.
It is, but I'll also say I would be the world's worst manager ever because I would have no idea how to manage a bullpen. It's tough. We've talked about that tons of times. It's the toughest thing a manager has to do.
Yeah, it is, but you can be good at it. Just ask Bruce Bochy. You're able to be good at it by running a bullpen like that, and I don't think Walt Weiss is very good at it. We've had a discussion on this podcast before, but there are times where you go, okay, maybe he's figuring it out, and then something happens, you just go, oh.
Maybe not.
Okay.
Maybe not. But maybe I think, right now the Rockies at least give you a little bit of a, we all enter Rockies seasons like a little kid going to get a shot at the doctor's office. So your eyes are clenched tightly shut. And every once in a while, the Rockies do something that makes you want to slightly open one eye and think maybe this isn't going to be that bad. And that's like what the last week has felt like, They go out, they play really good games. That series in Chicago was fantastic. Even the game against Jake Arrieta, they were in that game.
Yeah. And then, you get the nurse who's just learning how to draw blood, and she keeps missing the veins, and she just keeps, like, stabbing you. You go, why are you doing this to me? What did I do to you? And she goes, oh, I'll get it.
Eventually, after spending 5 months in the hospital, after losing the majority of the blood in your body, then you just contract a staph infection and die. And that's pretty much how Rocky seasons usually go.
By August, yeah.
Yeah. So, this year, maybe you'll get the old veteran who knows where to find the vein. A weird analogy we've concocted here.
I think it works for us. I don't know.
Rockies, as a team offensively, I really, really like a lot of what we've seen. Trevor Story, yes, is going to go through his adjustment period. We've talked about that ad nauseum, yet for some reason people still want to complain about what Trevor Story is doing right now. I don't know. Just try to... At some point, try to be happy about something in life.
Just shut up.
23 years old. He's leading the major leagues in homers. And yeah, he's a rookie. He's going to get struck out by things. He's going to be made to look silly. That's baseball. If Trevor Story still looks like this in 2 years, then complain about Trevor Story. For now, shut up. Just enjoy what you're seeing from a kid who's doing something that nobody anywhere in the world has any business doing at 23 years old. Just try to open yourself up to the idea that maybe the world isn't a total garbage heap and you can have some fun with sports. DJ LeMahieu has been fantastic. And thankfully, back in the lineup, dealt with a little groin thing. But
yeah.
DJ's looked great again offensively. And I think is maybe serving notice that last year wasn't a fluke. DJ, I don't think is ever going to be a guy who sticks around hitting 320, 330. But if DJ can hang around the 300 mark and post an OPS, of 800 plus, I think you're pretty damn happy with getting that out of DJ. And the thing that I really love is how good Carlos Gonzalez is swinging the bat so far. Because that is something that we have not seen over the last couple of seasons in April, especially.
Especially early on. That's not really been his forte in his career is the April numbers, but this year he has been just absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Career 277 hitter, a 799 OPS in April, which is his lowest of any month out of the season. But this year he has been absolutely unbelievable so far. A 367 average, got two more hits today, two doubles, an RBI. He's OPSing nearly 1100, a 415 on base percentage. He's only struck out 13 times in 15 games, which for Carlos Gonzalez early in the season is very, very impressive. He's walked five times. He and Nolan Arenado have been the Bash brothers, basically, in that middle of that Rockies lineup. And it's exactly what you're looking for when you have those two guys. You pencil the two guys in every single day. Arenado, a little slow on the average. He had a couple of hitless games to end that Red Series at 267 right now, but the OPS at 940, six home runs, 16 runs batted in. And the important thing this year with Nolan Arenado that I love more than anything, right now, he has 5 walks and 4 strikeouts in 15 games. Think about that.
That is pretty impressive.
You strike out a lot, and he's not going to walk a lot. But 4 strikeouts in 15 games. He struck out 110 times last year. and he has 4 strikeouts in 15 games in 65 plate appearances.
It's pretty good. That is pretty good.
I'm just saying.
That's Nolan, you know, the thing that I love now about watching this team is Trevor Story on the left side of the infield looks like somebody who used to play on the left side of the infield there and makes it, you know, Nolan, you get excited when there is a ground ball and you see it from the center field camera and it looks like it's heading to the third base side of the left side of the infield when it looks like Nolan's going to have a play on it. Now I feel that way again about seeing a ball that looks like it's hit toward Trevor Story. Anything that's on the left side of the infield and on the ground is so exciting. It's not just that these guys are doing it with the bat. It's so much fun to watch this infield play. Mark Reynolds is fun to watch play. You know?
Yeah, just not to watch hit for the most part, but yes, he is fun to watch. And yeah, it's I think we were undersold on Trevor Story's defense. I know we had stories last year from Chris Jackson in Albuquerque when Trevor would make some crazy plays. He'd be like, you guys don't understand how good this guy is with his glove.
Yeah.
And I think we're getting that now. He had a brilliant play last night on Billy, or was it today? I'm all lost. On Billy
back
Hamilton.
Back-to-back days on Billy Hamilton. Yeah.
He was going to his right, going in the hole, and he backhanded a ball and in one motion made a strong throw to nab the fastest guy in baseball at first base.
That one was today, and Nolan cut down Hamilton on basically a perfect bunt attempt yesterday and somehow got him by a step at first. Nobody gets Billy Hamilton. Nobody on those plays gets Billy Hamilton, but both Nolan and Trevor Story somehow make that happen.
Unbelievable.
They're really good. They're very good at baseball. Let's head down to the farm. Let's talk a little bit of prospect action. I want to start with one Jeff Hoffman, right-hander out of Latham, New York, 6'5", 225 pounds. You may have heard of him. He was acquired in a trade last year.
For who?
I think the Rockies sent Max Suzuki to the Mariners and got him back.
God, Max Suzuki. I miss him.
Jeff Hoffman yesterday for the Albuquerque Ice Dopes. We're recording this on Wednesday. Yesterday, the 19th, worst start of the season. 3 2/3, 6 hits, only 3 runs and only 1 earned. Struck out 5 and walked 2. But after the game, I thought this was interesting. And again, it's courtesy of Chris Jackson of the Albuquerque Examiner. These were some of the quotes from AAA Albuquerque manager Glenn Allen Hill. Quote, "For me, it was his pace was way too slow. The tempo in between pitches. He was taking it down to 1 second," referring to the pitch clock. "I'm sure when we meet with him tomorrow and talk to him, we'll find out if anything is going on. His tempo was way too slow." Then he continued later and said, "Especially after we had some long innings, you'd think he'd want to get back out there and start attacking, but his tempo was just too slow." You don't often hear a manager that openly talk about like, no, this is the issue. I centered in on the issue. This is the exact issue, and this is what I'm going to hammer home. But I like that in this, and I also like that it happens in April because it shows you, A, Jeff Hoffman has had some really, really good success so far through his first 2 starts this season. He had only given up 2 runs over 13 innings, 8 hits. He had struck out 9. He'd walked 4, had an ERA of 1.38. Opponents are batting 178 against him. But B, it shows you there's still room for growth. And I want to have guys like this have these starts because those are where you learn your lessons. So for Jeff Hoffman to go out yesterday and kind of get knocked around a bit against a Reno team that he got the win against his previous time out, I'm fine with that. Next time is going to be the indicator. How does he adjust? What does he do next time through?
Yes. And, you know, it's still not even a year since he came back from his Tommy John surgery. So maybe he's still figuring things out. It was his first start in Albuquerque, which may have been the difference. Who knows? His first 2 starts were at Tacoma and then at Reno. So whether something was an issue with the mound or whether he wasn't picking up the signs or whether he was a little bit winded, who's to say? But it's good Glenn Allen Hill's getting out in front of the problem right now. Thinks he has a beat on it. And I think next time is going to be very, very important for Jeff Hoffman to see how he responds.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that you just made. I mean, this is a guy who this time a year ago was still rehabbing from Tommy John surgery in 2014. And this is his first full season assignment, really. I mean, last year he gets a full season assignment in that he starts a Class A advanced and jumps up to Double A, but he didn't get started last season until about the middle of the year, you know, from the full season perspective of things. So this is a new animal. Pitching in April as a professional is a new animal to Jeff Hoffman. And I like that Glenn Allen Hill is immediately out there to nail down what he perceives to be the issue and say, this is how we attack it going forward. I like that. I really like that.
Big fan. Big fan. Big fan. Also, Jordan Patterson hitting like 400.
Yeah.
10 walks, 7 strikeouts. Yeah.
You know, Not bad. I mean,
OPSing for OPSing 1025, a 491 OBP. Jordan Patterson.
They don't have the sexiest names on that roster, especially when you compare them with Hartford. But there's some guys there who would, you know, doing pretty well.
So Jordan Patterson could be the first guy called up should another injury happen to an outfielder, or if they want to try to cut down on Mark Reynolds' playing time. Who knows? Or if they want to get somebody besides Brandon Barnes in there. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows?
Swinging a good bat. He's a tough out. Rafael Ynoa. Real tough out.
He's a 292.
Double A Hartford. Very fun team, as you are all quite aware. The Yard Goats at 9-4 sit atop the Eastern League's Eastern Division so far. They have started the season pretty good.
Got their 10th win today, actually, in fact.
Oh, yeah, that's right. These are the numbers coming into the day today, and they got their 10th win today. And David Dahl hit yet another home run today. So David Dahl threw now 14 games, 6 home runs, 13 runs batted in. He's OPSing 871. That's pretty good. And also, some guys who are starting to come on and get things figured out. That pitching staff has looked really good. Kyle Freeland, his last time out, best start of the year, 7 innings, 5 hits, 1 unearned run. He struck out 5. He only walked 1. He's only walked 1 batter in each of his 3 starts so far this season. So Freeland has looked really, really good. Antonio Senzatella, I'll be curious to see what things are like for him his next time out. I believe he actually, did he go today for Hartford? No, he did not.
No.
So he might be on the docket for tomorrow, because last time out, he only pitched 2 innings. And the Yard Goats said he just really could not get loose. They were on the road at Portland, Maine, taking on the AA affiliate of the Red Sox, the Portland Sea Dogs. And in that game, Senzatella only went 2 innings, gave up 3 runs on 4 hits. Game time temperature that day was 49 degrees, and they said Senzatella just never really got loose. So hopefully that's not anything, but, you know, it does make you a little bit concerned. Modesto had a very strange play the other day. You can find this story on MILB.com that I wrote up after talking with some guys on the Modesto side, Freddie Ocasio, their manager. Modesto got a run home on a balk called on a catcher.
Yeah, catcher balk.
Yeah. That is so weird. I knew that that was a thing, because I remember as a kid learning, oh, this is why catchers always keep a foot in the box when they're receiving a pitch or an intentional walk pitch.
Right.
But I did not realize that you could actually call a balk on a catcher for, in this circumstance, Modesto, which I already forgot who they were going against in this game. Lake Elsinore, I think. Either way, catcher, it was a pitch out with Max White on first base, who had already stolen a base earlier in the game. On the pitch out, the catcher jumped out of the plate before the pitch was delivered and was called for a catcher's balk. The balk goes assigned to the pitcher, but it's basically called on the catcher, and it brought a run home from third, and it sent Max White to second base. Thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah, Max White, by the way, 8 for 8 in stolen bases this year.
He's good. They have some speed. They have some speed on that team.
He's also hitting .341.
They got some burners, and Freddie Ocasio he's a good dude to talk to. He really likes
25 steals, 8 caught stealings. Forrest Wall, by the way, hitting .340 as well.
Heart eye emoji. Love me some Forrest Wall. He unfollowed me on Twitter. The bot that runs at Forrest Wall 7 followed me and then unfollowed me on Twitter. That's a weird account. Very confused as to
you
the
must
Forrest
feel
account.
Terrible about yourself if that's the case.
I do.
Because you love Forrest Wall.
I do. I don't know what I did to anger Forrest Wall.
Yeah. Good job, guy.
I still follow him because I love him. So that brings us to the team that we wanted to talk about, which is the struggling team wise Asheville Tourists, but the starring personally wise. Brendan Rodgers.
Yeah, Brendan Rodgers, his first 12 games in full-season professional baseball as a 19-year-old. Right now, he is slashing .298, .377, .574. That is good for a .952 OPS. He has 4 home runs. He's driven in 9. Had his first multi-home run game as a professional last night. He's got 11 strikeouts, 6 walks.
Career high 4 RBIs in that game as well.
Yeah. It is pretty much as good a start as you can possibly imagine for Brendan Rodgers, and it's what the Rockies wanted to see. He's doing it everywhere. He's committed only 3 errors in those 12 games too, considering as a shortstop, a guy making his first appearance in full season pro ball. He's played second base a couple of games too as well, so he's getting around the infield as well. But everything about Brendan Rodgers so far, this is exactly why you picked this guy third overall last year.
He's good. He's really good at baseball. The thing that I really like about Brendan Rodgers' start is this is exactly what he said he wanted as an indicator for his second professional season. He said last year, you know, such a long year. High school season ended on April 20th, a year ago today, actually, as we're recording this. And then he didn't get his first start in professional ball until really the end of June. So he never really felt like he got into a good rhythm going into pro ball. So the offseason, the focus was all on staying healthy, getting stronger, making sure that he'd be there for the rigors of an entire full season slate, and getting started on a good note. Because he started pretty slowly last year for Grand Junction. So for Rodgers, this is best case scenario. And that's really exciting, because when an 18, 19-year-old says, this is what I want to do, if it doesn't go that way, you don't really know how all those guys are going to respond. And again, Brendan Rodgers, similarly to Trevor Story, he's going to slump. That's how professional baseball works. There will be a stretch this season where South Atlantic League pitchers or California League pitchers, wherever it is, they will figure out something with Trevor Story that they can exploit, or with Brendan Rodgers, that they can exploit the way major league pitchers have figured out some stuff with Trevor Story that works. That's just the way it goes. But again, like what we were talking about a minute ago with Jeff Hoffman, the adjustments are the key in the minors. It's not just having success. It's when things pivot away from you, how quickly can you rein them back in? So that's what I'll be excited to see next from Brendan Rodgers.
That's the thing, because most of these guys, when they're growing up, they've never experienced failure on a like macro level. It's been like, oh, I went 0-for-4, and then it went back out the next night and went 4-for-4 with 4 home runs. These guys have always been the best players on their respective teams. They probably hit like 600 in high school, a guy like Brendan Rodgers, more than likely. So when they get to professional baseball and they do hit that first extended slump, the first 1-for-13, the first 0-for-12, or whatever it ends up being, that's when you really find out the character of a guy. It's like, okay, I'm going to get better. I'm going to work on this. I'm going to spend extra time in the cage. Or is it a guy like, ah, screw it, all done, bye. You know, I don't think Brendan Rodgers is that kind of guy. And we saw that a little bit last year. He's already got more home runs this year in 12 games than he did in 37 in Grand Junction. He's improved his walk rate, and his strikeout rate has been virtually unchanged from last year, which is also a very good sign in the early going. So Brendan Rodgers, it's going to be, you know, when he hits that first little slump that we see what we're going to have with Brendan Rodgers. But right now, man, how could you not want a better start than this, what you've seen from the number 3 overall pick last year?
That's the other thing I like about Brendan Rodgers. You talk about the walk and strikeout rates. I mean, he struck out 11 times in 12 games so far. He's walked 6 times. But in Brendan Rodgers' high school career, in his career, he walked, and now keep in mind, this is only over 47 games in total, but in his high school career, he walked 23 times and struck out 22 times. So the eye is there. By the way, he slashed 378, 471, 804 in high school.
Oh,
that's pretty good. And it's not like this is a kid who, oh yeah, but who was he playing against? I mean, he played at a big time Florida high school program. It's not like he's playing against scrubs. Like, it's obviously not D1 baseball, but it's pretty impressive to OPS 1275 in your high school career.
It doesn't suck.
You know, it's maybe not the same as in the South Atlantic League, but oh, by the way, he's OPSing 952 so far in the South Atlantic League. So that's really good. It's that's a very encouraging thing to see right out of the gate, that this is a goal that a kid set. I want to be healthy. I want to start fast. And he's healthy and he's starting fast. And this is what the Rockies knew they were getting. Right now, he's MLB.com's number 10 ranked overall prospect in all baseball. He's a really exciting talent. And what will be interesting is if he continues to do it at this pace, do the Rockies challenge him similarly to what they did with Kevin Padlo last year? And with Padlo, it was different. They sent him to Asheville and then ended up sending him back to short season ball, a lower draft pick, and not quite the same level of expectations, obviously, but do they follow a similar track with Rodgers if he's just killing the ball through April, May into June? Do they test him then by saying, all right, kid, go see the California League now? I mean, he's 19, it'd be very young for the level, but you know, I mean, when you and I were in the Carolina League, my first season of the Carolina League was Jason Hayward and Freddie Freeman. They were both 19 that year, which is an equivalent level to the California League.
Yeah. I mean, what also helps, I think, right now is what Trevor Story is doing at the big league level. It's not like they're looking at Brendan Rodgers to be the savior of shortstops because they're starting Daniel Descalzo every day. And that's no offense to Daniel Descalzo, but he's not going to be hitting like you would expect a franchise-changing shortstop to hit. And Brendan Rodgers, you draft a guy that high, you assume he's going to be hitting at the big league level within a few years, of course. Obviously, there's, you know, with the coming out of high school, there's a little bit of a waiting period. But I think what Trevor Story's doing right now at the big league level is giving Brendan Rodgers a little bit of breathing room where he can just kind of sit back and relax and kind of just be him and do his own thing. And the Rockies can promote him as aggressively or, you know, aggressively or as they want to, whether it's this year going up to Modesto or whether it's sticking the entire year in Asheville like they've done with David Dahl and Raimel Tapia and Ryan McMahon, some of their bigger guys. The only difference was they brought up David Dahl late in it when his year he was at Asheville, correct? To Modesto for like a month,
right,
and then brought him
then
back
sent
for
him
the
back
playoff
to
run.
Asheville, right.
Right. So
that was 2014.
Maybe even something
Dahl.
Like that could happen. But yeah, I think the what Story's doing right now is a only good news for Brendan Rodgers. Just letting him relax, be his own player, and not being forced to be the face of the franchise at such a young age.
Daniel Descalso, by the way, hits for a surprising amount of power on MLB The Show.
Oh, I traded him. I'm sorry.
Oh, I traded Reyes the first day I got
Oh, well,
that
yeah.
Game.
Duh. I mean, yeah.
And I should trade Descalso, but I started a franchise before the rosters had updated with Story, so I don't have Story up
well,
there.
That's stupid. Just go back and restart it.
Yeah, maybe I should just go back and restart it. That's true. That's true. Let's discuss the impetus behind episode 71. We talked about this a few weeks ago, that we were out of players for a short span of time to name our episodes after. But episode 71 is a very interesting one. And Anthony, since you always give us the goods on who episodes are named after, give us the goods on who this
episode number 71.
And we've left it until way late in the episode, but here we go.
Yes. Is named for none other than Chinwe Cao. Chinwe Cao was a signee of the Rockies as an amateur free agent in 1999. It was a top prospect of the team for what, three seasons, I believe.
Three out of 4 years, according to Baseball America, 2001, 2002, and 2004, Chinwe Cao was the top prospect in the Rockies organization. He was the number 15 prospect in all of baseball, according to Baseball America, prior to 2001, and he was four times, according to Baseball America, a top 100 prospect. He was number 15 in 01, dropped back to 61 in 93 in 2002 and 2003, and then rocketed back up to number 24 in 2004, prior to the 2004 season.
He spent three seasons with the Rockies from 03 to 2005. He made 29 appearances, eight of them starts, 4-3, a 5.80 earned run average, struck out 44 batters and 63 and two-thirds, and then was out of baseball for a year. Resurfaced with the Dodgers back in 2007, and then was out of baseball from 2008 until making his comeback with five games with the Dodgers last year in 2015. Tyler, what was he doing in those 8 years?
In between was a very long road for Chinwe Cao. This is a guy who one day, if I hit the Powerball or if I figure out what, you know, like real writers do to write books, Chinwe Cao would be a fascinating guy to talk to because, as many of you may know from the fall, I went to Taiwan, broadcasted some baseball games for an international tournament there this past November. And over there, baseball fans still talk about Chinwe Cao the way American baseball fans would talk about Roger Clemens or would talk about Cy Young, people of a certain era, because Chinwe Cao broke barriers that nobody had ever broken before. When Cao made his major league debut for the Rockies on July 25th, 2003, he was the first Taiwanese pitcher in major league history. And that's a baseball mad country. And it is an area of the world that has exported some talent and never forgotten what that talent is. I mean, we have seen other guys break into the minor league or break into the big leagues from Taiwan and have decent success. But when you have a small baseball hamlet like that, especially in a part of the world where you are surrounded by other baseball powers in Japan and in Korea, for Taiwanese players, that is the most elite of elite groups. Chinwe Cao, I mean, Chaeshwan Lin is another one that people remember. Of course, probably the most famous.
Oh, yeah, I remember Chaeshwan Lin from
Chaeshwan
Salem.
Lin was in Salem when we were,
And Shishen Zhang, I believe.
Yeah, Shishen Zhang was the other one. That's right. Yeah. And he, I think, is still kicking around the minors somewhere.
Yeah.
if I'm not mistaken. Chin Meng Wong is the most notable one, of course. Wong, who had a lengthy major league career and was last year was still in somebody's system, I wanted to say. But Hong Chi Kuo has seen some time. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. Chin Lung Hu was a pretty effective major leaguer for a while. I mean, Chin Lung Hu saw some time for the Dodgers. He actually played in 65 games back in the 2008 season. So these guys, I mean, this is a country that is not really in the conversation as one of the world's powers, but has a very proud baseball history. Its proudest baseball history is at the Little League level. Taiwanese Little League teams kill. And I believe Taiwan has the most international titles in Little League World Series history, but that's a whole different conversation. Anyway, back to Chin Wei Zhao. So 2003, breaks through, starts for the Rockies, first Taiwanese player to ever do it. Kind of flames out. Zhao had issues with his shoulder, which is, again, you know, we hate to circle back to a downer note at the start of the episode, but Miguel Castro, these are the reasons why you worry about shoulders. 2005, he had a torn labrum and debridement of the right rotator cuff that required surgery that forced him out for the entire 2006 season, and the Rockies let him go. 07, as Anthony noted, goes to the Dodgers. 08 goes to the Royals. But at the end of 2008, Chin Wei Zhao goes back to Taiwan, and he signs with the Brother Elephants in the Chinese Professional Baseball League, CPBL. And that's kind of a strange, they're named after a hotel chain, Brother Hotels, as I understand it. So the team name is the Elephants. But I always just, before I knew that, I just assumed that it was like the translation of like a Taiwanese term that they just refer to elephants as, like, Brother Elephant.
Right.
But it's not. It'd be better if it was. But he was drafted with the second overall pick in the first round in the 2008 CPBL draft, signed there, and in 2009 went 8-8 with a 3.93 ERA for the Brother Elephants. Pretty good. But at the end of that season, things got weird. After the 2009 Taiwan series, which is their World Series, he was under investigation for game-fixing allegations. And in February, the prosecutor's office in the Banqiao district declined to prosecute him for it, but announced that he had been accepting quote-unquote unsuitable benefits, including wine and sex, from the mafia, and therefore had allegedly agreed to throw two CPBL games in August 2009 for them.
I love wine and sex.
No, we all. And if I was, you know, also being paid a large sum of money, I'm sure that'd be terrific. But this is a huge thing. And it's a big thing. I mean, obviously, in the consciousness of any baseball fan, because of the Black Sox scandal, because of what gambling can do to professional sports. But in Taiwan, this is bigger than you could ever imagine, because Taiwanese baseball was basically racked and torn apart by gambling back in the mid-90s. There were several teams that were disbanded from the league. There were rumors that went on about this in 1996. In January of 1997, police in Taiwan arrested a handful of CPBL players who were suspected of gambling ties. 2005, there was another big game-fixing scandal there. And then in 2009 comes along this thing with Chin Wei Zhao. So the media announces, or the prosecutor's office announces, that he had been accepting these benefits and likely been throwing games. But the way that Chin Wei Zhao got off with this was that one of the games that he allegedly agreed to throw was canceled due to a typhoon. And the other one,
you can't make this stuff up,
he ended up turning down because not enough of his teammates agreed to go along with throwing the game. So he wasn't indicted, but was still kicked out of the CPBL because of the behavior.
He was the Shoeless Joe.
Exactly.
Shoeless Joe at 375 in that World Series.
None of those guys were indicted. That's what people don't remember about the Black Sox scandal. I mean, anybody who's done research about it, but everybody just assumes, oh, those guys got banned. Well, I'm sure there were criminal charges and whatever, and that's a whole different thing. But there weren't. They were just kicked out because Kennesaw Mountain Landis was a dick.
Yes.
So that's very similar to this, but in not exactly the same way. There actually seems to be pretty tangible evidence that Chin Wei Zhao had agreed to do this. So that was 2010.
But the gods, the Brother Elephants were in his favor?
The Brother Elephants were in his favor. That was 2010. And since then, Chin Wei Zhao, by the way, at that time was 29 years old. So tried coming back, tried playing some indie ball, seeing what he could do to make it back to play in affiliated ball in some stretch. Never really worked out. So Jinwei Zhao just kind of wandered in the baseball wilderness for a while until the Australian Baseball League agreed to bring him aboard with the Adelaide Bite in December of 2014. And I've worked with the ABL now. This is our sixth season, 2015-2016. This was huge news. That Jinwei Zhao, former major leaguer, a guy who was going to a place that has a decent Taiwanese population in Adelaide. I remember when I was down there in 2011, there was the following season, actually, Chin Lung Hu played for the Adelaide Bite, and they would turn out hundreds of Taiwanese fans per night to watch him. This is a big deal. But when the CPBL caught wind of this after banning Jinwei Zhao a few years prior, they put pressure on Major League Baseball, which is part owner of the Australian Baseball League, and the ABL to not let this signing go through. So the Bite signed Jinwei Zhao. They call a press conference. They announce this deal. He makes it all the way down to Adelaide. He's throwing a bullpen at Norwood Oval. He's touching the upper 90s. And then all of a sudden the Bite say, nah, just kidding. We're not going to do this. So Jinwei Zhao once more out of the deal, out of baseball. But then comes the weirdest turn of all. That was in December of 2014. And after it looked like Major League Baseball had said, yeah, you're right, he's been banned, gambling, we take that more seriously than anything, then the Los Angeles Dodgers stepped in and signed him. So at 33 years old, Jinwei Zhao then figured out a way to get back into professional baseball, and that was at the end of 2014. And last season, he returned with Double-A Tulsa last year, pitched in four games, 0-1, a 7.20 ERA, but saw the lion's share of his time with Triple-A Oklahoma City, 30 appearances, a 2.77 ERA, seven saves, and really looked pretty damn good. Throwing in the upper 90s again, good command. And
42-11 K to walk ratio.
Yeah. And returned to the major leagues 10 years after the Rockies had last seen him in 2005, and 8 years after he had last pitched in a major league game in 2007 with the Dodgers. He was back with the Dodgers last year after one of the weirdest roads you could ever imagine. There's a really good story if you want to get more on this. December 30th of 2014, Tim Brown of Yahoo Sports, who is one of the best baseball writers out there, put together an interesting look at just what the risks were for the Dodgers when they made that signing. But man, what a strange, strange road it's been for Jinwei Zhao. And a guy who had all, when he was the Rockies' top prospect, he was viewed as the best prospect they had ever had pitching-wise come right through the system. And it did not work out for him. The shoulder issues derailed his career. But man, what a fascinating situation that has turned into.
Yeah, we could have done an entire episode on Jinwei Zhao's entire career.
Weird.
And the arc that it's taken.
So weird. So weird. And the fact that he didn't get indicted or prosecuted for anything because one game was rained out and the other one nobody wanted to go along
typhoon.
With. Like, so he's agreeing to it and then he just can't even do that right.
Oh, man.
So we wanted to leave that little nugget for late in this episode, episode number 71, the Jinwei Zhao Memorial Edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. But what a weird deal there. How strange. And by the way, he's back in AAA Oklahoma City this year. So far, has pitched in six games, an ERA of 5.40, and he has converted two saves. So I would imagine, I mean, he's 35 and he throws upper 90s. We'll see him in LA at some point this year.
And with the Dodgers bullpen the way it is, I imagine we'll see quite a bit of Jinwei Zhao.
That's one of the best lines from Tim Brown's piece is he lists a couple of reasons why the Dodgers would be interested in Jinwei Zhao. And this is in 2014, remember, said, well, there's also a third. Did you see the Dodgers bullpen last summer? Taiwan may well look into banishing half of those guys, too. So Jinwei Zhao, interesting dude and a fun one to talk about for the 71st edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Did we cover everything?
I think we covered pretty much everything. We're going to talk about John Heyman's tweet about Nolan Arenado having a case for the third best, being the third best player in baseball. Go through really quickly. I don't know. John Heyman came out with a tweet and said that Nolan Arenado has an easy case to be the third best player in baseball. I'm assuming after Bryce Harper and Mike Trout, which, okay.
And Jose Reyes.
Did a little digging. Since the beginning of 2015, Nolan Arenado was third in home runs with 48, first in RBI, second in slugging percentage, third in isolated power, which is subtracting your average from your slugging percentage, first in total bases, first in extra base hits, and his 23 defensive runs saved are tied for second most among all infielders behind Andrelton Simmons. I think that's a pretty good case for being the third best player in baseball. And we're not saying he is. I mean, there's a lot to it. It's weird. So a lot of the weighted runs created plus and the OPS plus and the weighted on base average, they don't like Nolan as much as other metrics do because he doesn't walk as much as they think that he should. But
and
some
we
guys,
should be fair. We should point out that's the reason why MLB Network rated him the sixth best.
The sixth best
third baseman in baseball.
Not just
it wasn't
the third best player.
Right. It wasn't just a poll of who do you think is the best third baseman in baseball. It was based on a specific group of stats. So we should point that out.
But still.
But that doesn't make it any.
Justin Turner is not a better player than Nolan Arenado. And
right.
I
will
fight you if you say it.
And it's way more fun to just rip on it like it was just a bunch of guys sitting around like, I don't know, maybe sixth best among third basemen.
Yeah.
It's way more fun to rip it that way.
Yeah. Way easier. But still. Nolan Arenado. I mean, McCutcheon's in that argument, of course. Like Paul Goldschmidt's in that argument, of course. Manny Machado's getting there as well. Josh Donaldson. But I don't know, man. I think what Nolan does and how young he is and how much of a ceiling he still has, we still don't know what he's entirely capable of for a whole season. He could kill a man. We don't know. We don't know what he can do. What he's
shoot him in the middle of Fifth Avenue and he wouldn't lose any voters.
Exactly. So I think just if you look at the whole package, what he's already got three gold gloves on his mantle by the time he's turned 25. Like, the sky is literally the limit for a guy like Nolan Arenado. He could, if he's not right now the third best player in baseball, he could be within the next 2 years.
Yeah, I buy that. I buy that. I do like that somebody like John Heyman pays enough attention to that.
Exactly.
You know, to see it at the kind of bigger picture perspective that we've all seen from Nolan here for the last few seasons. So, you know, that's a good thing.
By the way, we had Mark Sweeney on Whip Around this week. And so I got to work with him. Mark Sweeney is the Padres sideline reporter slash color analyst when Mudcat is taking a break. And I saw him, and he, of course, knows that I'm a big Rockies fan. I was working on the show on Monday, and he came in and said that he was so impressed with three guys. Obviously, Nolan and Trevor Story, because those guys have been doing what they have done, you know, with Nolan for the last couple of years. Story for the first couple of weeks. That was still part of his incredible hot streak. But he said that the guy who impressed the most on the Rockies was Chad Bettis.
Wow.
Chad Bettis was, he was told by Walt Weiss before the series started that watch out for Bettis. I think you'll really like him. He's a bulldog mentality. He can go out. He knows how to pitch, get guys out. He pounds the zone. And Sweeney was like, yeah, sure, whatever. He's a Rockies pitcher. He saw him pitch on that Sunday game. And he came out most impressed with anybody on the Rockies was Chad Bettis.
We might have to get Chad Bettis on this show next week. I'm going to go. They've got a day game, I believe, next either Wednesday or Thursday. But when I was in the clubhouse the other day, he was standing around. I was going to try to get Trevor Story because he's, you know, obviously the biggest story of the first couple of weeks. But Chad Bettis was on the list of guys that I want to get very soon. He might be the guy that we have to get for next week because I am so happy to see what Chad Bettis has been able to turn himself into because, you know, organizations like to try guys in different roles. But the Rockies were ruining Chad Bettis using him as a reliever. And some guys just flat out cannot make that change. They can't make the decision mentally to, and I don't mean a conscious thing of like, okay, I'm going to be a reliever now, but your body cannot adapt to the routine of being a reliever when you have spent your entire life as a starter. And for Chad Bettis, he was on the verge of being one of those guys you look at and think, high draft pick, Rocky screwed him up. But to the Rockies' credit, and to Chad Bettis' credit, they said, all right, let's go back to the drawing board and try this starter thing then. If that's what worked, if that's what you've been successful with, and I think it was more a need. The Rockies had, you know, they needed arms in the bullpen. Bettis was a successful minor league starter. They wanted to see what they could get out of him in a relief profile at the major league level. But to their credit, they didn't continue trying to fit that square peg in that round hole. So right. I'm really happy for Chad Bettis because that's a guy who has so much potential and is now living up to it because he's doing something that he's comfortable with and he's finding a role that he's always wanted.
Yeah. I mean, he's gone 5 1/3 in all four, at least 5 1/3 in all four starts. He's gone at least 6 innings in his last 3 starts. He gave a couple of bad pitches today to Jay Bruce and Adam Duvall and gave a couple of home runs. But the last 2 starts, he's gotten 12 innings, give up 3 runs, only 6 hits in that time. On the season, a 3.33 ERA, 19 punchouts, just 6 walks, a 2.13 opponent average, and a 1.03 whip. Those are numbers that'll play anywhere, much less in Denver.
I like it. Maybe next week. Maybe that'll be our guest. We're gonna start getting guests back. Don't worry. It's
not just us. We're boring. It's already been like an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah. I'm starting a season. Anthony's starting a season. Just calm down, okay? It's been a stressful time.
God.
Just as an addendum to the Chin Hui Sao thing, between December 2010 and November 2012, he ran a barbecue restaurant in Hualien City, Taiwan, along with his former Brother Elephant's teammate, Chen Chi-Huan, who was also expelled by the CPBL due to game-fixing allegations. In 2014, his then-girlfriend, whose last name was Pan, evidently they don't give a first name in this little synopsis here, she told a newspaper that by the end of 2013, Chin Hui Sao had embezzled some $50,000 from her and the restaurant, so she filed a lawsuit against him, which remains unsettled. So, great character guy is what it seems like with Chin Hui Sao.
Yeah,
just wanted to add that addendum as I continue to read about Chin Hui Sao, because that was a facet of the story that I had not read before. So, if he makes it back up to Los Angeles, man. Enjoy it, Dodgers
fans.
Can't
wait.
All right, I think that'll do it. For the Chin Hui Sao edition. Thanks for tuning in. Rocky's back home on Friday for 7 games, Dodgers and Pirates in town. And we hope to see y'all out of the ballpark.
Yeah, first gray day of the season.
Yeah, first gray day of the season. Happy gray day coming up. Well, by the time you listen to this, it'll be tomorrow. Happy gray day on Friday. All right. Talk to you next week.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
I did not know that last part, that he embezzled.
That story's ridiculous, but at the end of it, you're just like, God, what an asshole.
Well, and like, also, I'm really bummed that this restaurant was not still open, but who are the people that are going to that restaurant? Like, well, this dude's a pretty obvious crook. I think I'm going to give him some of my money for bad barbecue.
Dude, Pete Rose has a chain of restaurants.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But he's still like a loved I mean, I guess maybe Chin Hui Sao is still like a
maybe
very
he's a cult
beloved
hero.
Yeah,
who
could
knows?
Be.
Yeah.
Could be. Yeah, the Brother Elephants, though, the all yellow uniforms, I love them. I have an Elephants jersey now. One of the dudes that I was over there with gave me, his now wife dated an Elephants player, and she gave this dude a jersey because she was like, oh yeah, I mean, I had this from him and I'm not really a baseball fan, but I thought you'd like it. And the guy was like, I don't want your ex-boyfriend's old jersey. Like, don't give this to me. So he just, like, one of the days we worked together last year at the Premier 12, he just brought it in and was like, here, you take this.
You want this?
Like, sweet, man. I'll take that jersey. That's awesome.